And the recording is on. It's so great to be with you and to be learning Torah with you all again. Today's topic in our Halacha in the Era of COVID series is something that came up very early on for many people. I actually don't know how common it would be in recent COVID history, but it was one of the earliest topics. And I know that it was one of the earliest topics because Rav Schechter from YU had been putting out a number of responses, and this is his first one. So we're going to have the opportunity to work on that together today. The topic for our learning today is Tefillat Kelim, immersing new Kelim that one buys, and what to do in the absence of a mikvah. That was a situation that many people were in. I'm curious, was anyone in this room in that situation before Pesach, buying new Pesach dishes and having to figure out something to do with them?
Yes.
Kelim mikvah.
Yeah,
I had to make an appointment for the Kelim mikvah.
Right, so many different solutions abounded, right? One involved just scheduling appointments. That was something many communities did. In my local mikvah was closed before Pesach. We had no way of dealing with it. So we had to rely on some other kinds of tools. I had recently bought a new coffee maker at the time. So different options. Stephen, I think you also said you had this situation. What, did you also make an appointment or did you do something different?
Hi, it's actually Amy.
I'm sorry.
Hi, no, we stacked all the stuff like in the corner of our kitchen and had to wait until I think it was probably like September or end of August until we finally made an appointment, took care of it. So we just put it aside. So
right,
that was our solution for better or for worse.
Right. So certainly a practical solution. And we're going to see a little bit of those today as well. So I'll start sharing my screen and we'll get a little bit of the background in and hopefully end with some of the kind of practical ideas. So we'll start with a quick overview of the mitzvah of Tefillat Kelim in the first place and hopefully move from there to some of the, you know, complications or different solutions to problems like this one. The mitzvah of Tefillat Kelim first appears in the Torah. It seems that it probably is a mitzvah min haTorah. In the middle of Sefer Bamidbar. This is after a war that Bnei Israel have. They, you know, have, you know, plundered the their enemies, and then they're being told what to do with all of the plunder that they have they've received as a result of this war. Elazar Kohen, at that point, it seems like the Kohanim were leading war in a way that's sort of interesting. So he told them, Zod Chukata Torah, Asher Tzivah Hashem et Moshe. This is the rule of the Torah. What is the rule? The rule is what to do with all of the kelim that we acquired. Ach et hazahav et hakesef, the gold and the silver, et hanachoshet vet barzel, the copper and the iron, et habedil vet haofaret, the tin and the lead, all of these metal tools that we've acquired. Kol davar asher yavo va'esh ta'aviru va'esh v'taher. Everything that was passed through fire, meaning a cooking utensil, something that had been used for, you know, food preparation, should be passed through fire again, and then it will be pure, and we'll be allowed to use it. This refers to the halacha of hechsher kelim, koshering kelim that we have, you know, either from meat to milk, or kelim that weren't kosher to making them kosher to use. This really isn't our issue for today. But the second half of the pasuk is, ach b'mei nida yitchata, you shall purify them with mei nida, with a certain kind of purifying water, and b'chol asher lo yavo ba'esh, anything that was not, you know, put in fire, was only, you know, used, seems to either be used only for cold things or just, you know, not used at all, still ta'aviru b'mayim, it also needs to pass through water. And this, according to Chazal, this is the rabbinic interpretation of this pasuk, is that it refers to a mitzvah of tefillat kelim, of immersing new kelim that one buys before one uses them. I'm going to put Rashi here. It also appears in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah as well. Rabotenu darshu mikan, the rabbi is inferred or derived from this pasuk. She'af lehachshiran min ha'isur hitin tefila leklim matchot. That for the purposes of koshering your dishes to allow them to be used, it's important to immerse them. And meinida that we saw in the pasuk, the meinida that we use, haktuvim kan, darshu mayim haru'uyim litvol behem nida. The same water, the same kind of immersion that a woman needs when she is in nida is also the kind of immersion that we expect from our utensils, our cooking utensils in particular, before we use them as well. So this sort of introduces us to the mitzvah of Tefillat Kelim sort of writ large. And we move from this local context of, you know, the plunder from war to all Kelim that we acquire. This is most, I think, clearly expressed in the Shulchan Aruch, in this third source here. And it adds a couple of caveats that we'll see actually fit the psukim very well and maybe solve some of our problems for us before we even get there. So the Shulchan Aruch reads as follows. Hakone meha Oved Kochavim, one who buys from Oved Kochavim, from non-Jews, klei se'uda, utensils for meals. It's unclear in this formulation whether it means utensils for cooking, utensils for eating. Conventionally, we'll usually immerse both. Shel matechet o shel zechuchit, that are either made of metal or of glass. O kelim hametzupim ba'avar mibifnim, or kelim that have this internal metal lining. Afal pishehim chadashim, even though they're new, meaning even though they've never been used for not kosher food before, so you wouldn't think you need to do anything to them to make them fit for use. Nonetheless, tzarich lahatbilam b'mikveh o mayan she'al arba'im sa'a. We still need to immerse them in either a mikveh or a mayan, I mean either a mikveh or a spring, a natural spring of water, of at least 40 sa'a of volume. And the other, you know, criteria of mikveh are also relevant here as well. The two criteria that I mentioned before, that I think come from the psukim very clearly, actually, are in the first line. Hakone meha Oved Kochavim. When one buys kelim from someone who isn't Jewish, this mitzvah applies. In the context of the psukim, they had also acquired these kelim from non-Jews. They hadn't bought them. They'd rather, you know, claimed them or conquered them. But nevertheless, it's that that context that becomes important. So for most of our kelim that we might buy, we're probably going to buy them from a department store or some store or online, but they will have at some point been owned by a non-Jew. And so Tefillat Kelim will mostly be important in that way. But we're going to bear that criteria in mind because that might come back a little bit later to help us. The second criteria that I think is interesting, and also comes out from the Pesukim, is that the klei seuda have to be made of metal or of glass. If you go to this bolded line in the Pesukim that we saw before, it lists six different kinds of metal to which the halacha of tefillah applies. And the rabbis assume that really the rule is that it applies to metal utensils, but not to utensils, for example, made of wood or made of pottery or other kinds of utensils. Glass is an addition, a rabbinic addition, to the rule. The assumption, I didn't bring the source here, is that metal and glass share in common the property of being able to be melted and reformed into new utensils. And so they have, you know, that detail in common, and the halacha of tefillah also applies to both of them in common. But to glass utensils only on a rabbinic level. So there'll be other things like, I said, wood before, plastic, a number of other kinds of utensils that we'll generally assume do not need to be immersed, certainly not with a bracha and possibly not at all. So this is the mitzvah that we have. It's a great mitzvah, but so far there doesn't seem to be a huge, you know, problem, right? I could buy a utensil. There's a mitzvah I'm supposed to do with it. Sometimes I can do the mitzvah. Sometimes I can't do the mitzvah. But okay, so if I can't do the mitzvah, okay, so it's a mitzvah that I missed because I'm not able to do it right now, and I'll do it later. And that would be the case, I think, except that halakhic interpretation has assumed not only that there's a mitzvah to do an immersion, but also that there's a prohibition on using kelim that have not been properly immersed. I just use one formulation from the Be'er Halacha, written by the same author as the Chafetz Chaim and the Mishneh Berurah. This is a bit more of an intensive analysis in this Sefer than you would see in some of his other writings. But he uses this formulation. This comes up in the context of Hilchos Shabbos for reasons that we'll see in a little bit, but there's a discussion about whether one can immerse utensils on Shabbos if one hasn't done so before Shabbos. And he says here, Mashen came b'kli chadash, with a new utensil, Gam im yishamish bo b'li tefila, even if you use it without having immersed it, eina ma'achal ne'asar. The food that you cook in it doesn't become asar. If I, you know, make a soup in a pot that I haven't immersed, nothing's wrong with the soup. You could keep eating it. V'aval gav da'avid isura, even though you did you violated a prohibition, you did an isar, v'mashim yishamish bo b'li tefila, in using it before it was properly immersed, nonetheless, the food itself is fine, and in the context of whatever halacha he's discussing, the halacha is also not a problem. And he mentioned at the end here as well, v'gam ein iser zeh klal ela midarabanan. This isn't a mitzvah midoraita. I mean, even though the mitzvah to immerse kelim seems to be a mitzvah from the Torah, though that's also disputed, certainly the prohibition involved in using a kli that had not been immersed is only a rabbinic prohibition, probably to encourage proper immersion of the utensils when you first get them. So afilu ledat hasovrim that tefillah hu min haTorah, even though the mitzvah is min haTorah, there's a rabbinic extra enactment. Sorry. Yeah.
Can I ask you a question?
Please.
If this is a mitzvah that's regarding metals, and why is this only applicable to like food-related vessels? Why, when you buy, like, say, new gold or silver jewelry, why do you not have to take that to the mikvah, to the kelim mikvah?
Yeah, so that's actually a really great question. I think it comes back to the context of the psukim in which the mitzvah originally appears. The context seems to refer, I think, to cooking utensils. When I use this formulation, kol davar asher yavo v'esh, the utensils that in which, that one would put into fire, then you have to put them in fire to purify them and to cleanse them.
But I always thought, and I could be totally wrong, that sure. The reason we do this is because these metals could have been used for avodah zarah by their prior owner. And if that is the rationale, which I'm not sure if that's right or not, if that is the rationale, that would apply to gold and silver also, which also had to go through, be soldered and melted in some way to be put into whatever form you've got it in now.
Right. So what you're pointing out, which is a good point in the psukim, is that it doesn't necessarily refer to utensils that one uses in fire. It could be utensils that one, creates in fire, right? You go to a blacksmith and you need to use fire to make some vessels but not make others. Regarding your first point, I'll show you a passage that we'll examine in a little bit more depth shortly. It's here, quoted in the Beit Yosef, which is the same author as the Shulchan Aruch, but a little bit more, again, of an intensive kind of work. He cites a passage from the Talmud Yerushalmi about the mitzvah of immersion. And I think it's what you were alluding to before. The purpose of tefillah, the tefillahu, kedesha yitzu mitumatan shal nachri, in order to take the utensils out of the impurity of non-Jews, liktushatan shal Yisrael, and raise them into the holiness of Jewish use. So that maybe that's what you were referring to. I don't know if that idea sounds familiar, or it's subtly different from what you were suggesting. You were suggesting this additional element of avodah zarah as a relevant concern, which doesn't seem to come up in this passage. But this is certainly a very similar idea. I guess one other element that maybe makes that seems to me important in why it applies to food items and not to non-food items, maybe two, right? One is that we have this additional mitzvah that we know called hechsher kelim, right? Koshering utensils that you have that have been used for things that weren't kosher. So the idea that these two mitzvot that appear in the same pasuk together should also apply to the same kinds of utensils seems sort of appropriate. And we may also think of utensils that we use as ones that require an additional level of kedusha, as opposed to things that, jewelry, while beautiful, isn't something that we use in the same way that we use utensils for food preparation. So there may also be a difference.
Okay, thank you.
Absolutely. It's gonna, it's due in the back of my mind. If something else comes to me, I'll be sure to share it. Okay. So at this point, sort of a broad overview of the mitzvah of tefillat kelim. The basic criteria, the basic mitzvah has appeared there. And also the sort of concurrent prohibition of using the kelim without having immersed them. And that's where the problem really is going to start. Because once there's a prohibition of using new kelim, then if I'm, making Pesach for the first time because all my Pesach programs have closed, I need to figure out what to do. If I buy new kelim but I don't have access to the mikvah, I'm going to be in trouble. So before we see section C of our analysis today is going to be some of the contemporary writings, contemporary poskim on this issue. But I want to lay the groundwork to appreciate where they're coming from by noting some of the extra details that come up in these halachot. And then we'll see how the poskim utilize those details for us. So starting with the potential solutions. So the potential solutions that were mentioned here involve sort of scheduling a time to use the mikvah. That seems to be the primary solution if you could do it, right? Obviously, if you have access to a mikvah, you could avoid the problem. That would be great. What if you can't do that? So one answer appears starting in the Shulchan Aruch and maybe reaching all the way back into that Yerushalmi I had mentioned before. The Shulchan Aruch rules, Hashoel o socher kli meha ovdei kochavim. If I rent or if I borrow or rent a kli from a non-Jew, then eno ta'un tfila, then I do not need to immerse it. Sort of an odd halacha, right? Meaning one would never say that if I borrow a kli from a non-Jew, I don't have to make sure that it's kosher. I don't have to kosher it if it was used for pork. But it is the case, according to the Shulchan Aruch, that I don't need to immerse it if I'm only borrowing it and not owning it permanently. And the suggestion that I think best explains this detail comes from that Yerushalmi we had mentioned before. If the purpose of Tfilat Kelim is to change the status of the utensil from that used by non-Jews to that used by Jews, the additional holiness that, with which we imbue our objects, then it might only apply when we take full ownership of the object, when it now becomes ours and is totally removed from their domain. But if they have maintain a right to it, if they're going to take it back from you when you're finished using it, then it hasn't properly transferred into the Kedusha with which we would imbue it. And that's why about a line later in the Yerushalmi, you have this line, Lo shanu ela lokeach. The halacha is that only one who takes an object from non-Jews has to do a tefillah, aval shoel mutar, but one who borrows it does not need to do so. And I think these two halachot are linked, which is why they're appearing in the same discussion in that source. Right? Because it's about transferring and elevating the status of the object, it only applies when you're taking it fully. So that raises for us the possibility, and the possibility that Poskim will certainly take advantage of. What if we have a way of using objects without taking full ownership of them? Right? What if we could find a way to, you know, borrow it from non-Jews or not own it, but still make use of it? That's going to become one avenue that people will take pretty seriously. Avenue number two that we might consider, I had forgotten the source, but I actually quite like it because it seems to solve our problem for us very explicitly. This is a halacha a little bit later in the same section of Shulchan Aruch. There's only one siman in Shulchan Aruch that deals with these halachot, so a lot of it appears in the same place in Yoredeya. Im shachach velo hitvil kli me'erev Shabbat o me'erev Yom Tov. If you forgot, you didn't immerse your vessel before Shabbat starts, now Shabbat starts and you want to, you know, use this on Shabbat, you have new plates or a pot or whatever it is that one might want to use. So the solution for you is not to immerse it on Shabbos, which is a controversial issue as to whether one's allowed to do that or not. But instead, yitznenu le'ovid kochavim b'matana, you should give it to a non-Jew as a gift, va'achar kach yishalenu mimenu, umutar le'shamish bo, and then you should borrow it from him and use it, but the title to the object really now belongs to the non-Jew to whom you lent it and not to yourself. Worth noting, I think, that in the social, you know, this only works in certain social contexts, meaning it only works in a place where non-Jews live and where one has amicable enough relationships with people who aren't Jewish to be able to work out these solutions, which wouldn't have been a given in every time and place in Jewish history, but seems to have been something that was applicable in the time and place of the Shulchan Aruch.
I'm sorry, can I ask a question? Am I understanding you right that if I want to go and borrow my not Jewish neighbor's saucepan and make soup in it or something, I can do that?
Well, you have to kosher it.
But he's saying you don't have to tovel it.
Right, you could kosher it, but not tovel it.
Right. Right, that's exactly it. It's worth noting that on the record.
Okay.
Right. One would need to kosher it, but, you know, there are situations where you might not need to. You know, knives are a tricky thing, but, you know, forks and spoons, things that might have only been used for cold food, not for hot food, or things that are relatively new. There are ways of doing it where you wouldn't need to kosher it. And there are also situations where you can kosher it, but koshering it might be easier than toveling it because, you know, you don't need access to an external mikvah to kosher things. You could kosher things in your own kitchen. But thank you for asking that clarifying question. Right. So the Shulchan Aruch allows that explicitly as an option on Shabbos. Right, to give your own kelim, which you know are kosher, and borrowing them back. And the Ramah, representing Ashkenazi minhag, expands it slightly. But it seems like the Shulchan Aruch would agree as well that you could even do this on a weekday if you don't have a mikvah. Meaning, on Shabbos, the reason you might be allowed to get away with this, even though, you know, it's a little tricky, right? It's not, you know, you are bending over backwards, you know, not actually tovo the thing. But on Shabbos, you're not allowed to, or on the Shabbos, at least it's controversial to do so. And on a weekday, if there's no mikvah, also you're not able to do so. So the way to get around it is to, you know, find a loophole where you don't own it. It belongs to someone who isn't Jewish, so you don't need to go through that process of making it
I
sort of
find it with again. 729 number, and I'm looking at Yair Lichtman giving a shir, comma. How do I get to us? Question mark.
Hold on. Sorry, thank you. Good to see everyone. Okay, so that's one option, right? Giving it to a non-Jew to deal with that issue. Option number two that is discussed is a similar process, right? The principle is if I don't own the vessel, I don't need to immerse it. So one way to do that is to give it to someone else. And another way to solve that problem is to declare it ownerless in the first place so that no one owns it. This is a process called hefker, that I could be mafgir my objects, decide that they're ownerless, and then make use of them while not claiming title to them. This is what I did. I bought a new coffee maker for Pesach, and what I done, and we'll see the process in which Rav Schechter describes how to do this, I declared it ownerless and then used it without claiming ownership to it. In principle, if someone had, you know, walked into my house and taken it from me, I would have had no right to claim it back. But I had use of a coffee maker during Pesach, which for me was a very important thing. Some of the details involved come up in the Shulchan Aruch in a different section. He describes how many people one needs in order to declare something ownerless. Apparently, I can't just stand here and, you know, hold this coffee cup and say, now this is ownerless, and have it be ownerless. I need to at least inform a certain number of people that that's what I'm doing. So Shulchan Aruch says that, midin Torah, afilu hefker b'fnei echad hareza hefker. If I make something hefker in front of only one other person, it's hefker. On a biblical level, aval midivrei sofrim eino hefker ad sheyafkir b'fnei gimel. But I might need, on a derabanan level, to announce in front of three people. We'll come back to those details in a minute. And the Rama here, the second line, v'yish omrim da'afilu b'eino levin atzmo have a hefker. The Rama says, maybe there are some opinions that would allow me to take this coffee cup and say, this is hefker, and have it then be hefker. That's going to be another avenue that people might consider. And the third consideration that might be borne in mind, besides declaring it ownerless or giving it to someone else, is this passage from Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, a much more contemporary posek than the Shulchan Aruch, but he raises the suggestion that shebimikre ze patur mitfila, in a situation where it's impossible for a person to immerse their vessel because they don't have access to a mikvah or to a body of water, then it might be that under such circumstances, there's not even a mitzvah that I wouldn't say there's not even a mitzvah, but that one would be exempt from it. One would be allowed to use the vessel without immersing it. Meaning the mitzvah to do it is only when it's possible to do it. And when it's impossible to do it, the mitzvah is not applicable, according to this view. That might be another consideration one might keep in mind when trying to answer or evaluate these questions. Okay. Before we look at some of the contemporary presentations, are there any questions, comments, observations? Okay. So let's look at some of the contemporary presentations. We probably won't cover all of them, but we'll try to note, just like we did last time, some of the aspects of the presentation that are interesting and worth bearing in mind, in addition to the actual halachic positions being advocated. So the first, and I just thought this was funny, so I thought it was worth sharing. This is from Halachapedia. Halachapedia is a website, sort of a Wikipedia for halacha, that was made or founded by students at YU. Most of the, I don't want to say most, maybe all of the presentations are vetted by the Rosh Yeshiva at YU, or Rav Willig or Rav Schechter. You know, look at all of these things before they're put out. And it turns out to be a very useful resource. But in this case, let me zoom in a little bit just to make it a little more visible. This is their treatment of this issue. They have a section, halacha related to coronavirus. This is how they deal with the issue here. And you would see that there's confusion as to what exactly to recommend. So first question is, should you even close your mikvah? They say every community should decide whether they should close it or not, depending on the safety needs of that community. And if you close a mikvah, it's still possible to immerse your kelim in an ocean or in a lake or in any other body of natural water. So it's still possible to do the mitzvah as normal. Alternatively, they provide an option number two. Maybe you can immerse it in a mikvah, but have everyone wear gloves and wash everything with soap and try to minimize transmission. So maybe you shouldn't really close the mikvah in the first place. And if the community has other procedures for safety, also observe those. On the third line, we have the last resort. At the last resort, you could avoid the issue by giving them to a non-Jew and then borrowing them back. And if you're not able to do so yourself, then it's possible that you could rely on an online site to sell your kelim, the same way we sell our chametz. We use online tools involved in selling our chametz to non-Jews. So too, we could sell our kelim to non-Jews in the same way. After the last resort, they then introduce another option. And the another option is to declare something ownerless in a way that we'll see in a little bit. And the another option is something at the very end we see that others disagree with. And after the last resort, and then the another option after the last resort, then we have, if there are no other solutions, the following rule is at play. So I thought it was worth noting, right? And that the final rule that they mention is that you could use the pots even without immersing them during these extenuating circumstances, like that position of Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach that we had seen. So they have a hard time, I think, prioritizing exactly what solution comes first in what order compared to other solutions. And you see that in their different formulations of the possible options, which I thought was worth noting. I would also, as a rule, not recommend, you know, making halakhic decisions purely based on what one finds on websites. So, but nonetheless, it is a useful resource. And certainly for research purposes, I found it to be very useful. I just thought it was worth sharing this this detail. But now to some of the poskim themselves and their actual writings on the issue. We'll start or continue, I guess, with the position of Rav Nevensal, who's a posek in Yerushalayim. This is from an oral Q&A that was then transcribed very, very early on. This is from March 22nd. The question, they've closed down a lot of mikvahs for kelim, and they cannot be tovel kelim for Pesach. What should one do? And Rav Nevensal's solution is they could give their kelim to the wife who is being tovel. Meaning the idea that the mikvah for kelim is being closed, but the mikvah for women is not being closed. And so both mikvahs are kosher. So when you go to be tovel, you also bring your kelim with you and you dunk everything at the same time, or you know, you dunk something before or after. But only if, in this next question, maybe there are certain women's mikvahs that do not allow bringing kelim, could they rely on selling to a goy and borrowing? And then Rav Nevensal says, yeah, you could also rely on that if you need to. I enjoyed this. I thought it was a great indication of the way that sometimes we'll see poskim who, when faced with a halachic problem, will first work on practical solutions before they work on halachic solutions. So if the problem is we don't have access to a body of water that's kosher for a tefillah, the response might be, well, no, let's try to find a body of water that's kosher. And sometimes it'll be a lake or an ocean, as Halachapedia suggested. And sometimes it'll be another mikvah that we'll have access to. This isn't itself like a novel position in halacha. This is just an application of things that we've already seen. And just sort of applying them to a practical reality in a way that I think is pretty interesting. Okay. That's sort of practical position number one. Position number two comes from, before we do Rav Willig's position, let's actually move to Rav Schechter, who has written on this first. I think Rav Willig is in some ways responding to Rav Schechter's presentation in a way that I'll point out soon. I switched tabs. Can everyone still see the position, the Tshuva of Rav Schechter I'm now looking at?
Yes.
Okay, great. Just wanted to make sure that was coming through. This is also one of those positions that Tshuva of Rav Schechter, much like I mentioned last time, where there is a pretty stark difference in presentation, not in halacha, but in presentation between the Hebrew and the English. So we may spend time looking at that, but the thing I'm most interested in is the English guidance, because that seems to be the public presentation of his ruling, right? He's publishing these online in a way that he does not publish many of his rulings. He's publishing them for the a wider audience, and not just a rabbinic audience. And so the way he writes in English is going to be something that's pretty important. So let's take a look at his presentation here. He starts off by introducing the mitzvah, much like we did today. Aside from the mitzvah of performing tefillas kelim, there's also a prohibition to use metal and glass dishes and utensils prior to their immersion. That's what we saw in the Bi'ur Halacha and the writing of the Mishnah Berurah. And he describes the problem, right? In these days, when coronavirus has closed many mikvos, then a reasonable effort should be made to find a natural body of water, an ocean, a pond, to immerse the vessels in. If that's too difficult, in the second paragraph, it would be overly strenuous to travel and immerse the utensils in such a body of water. One should try and use disposable utensils whenever possible, relying on the opinion of Rav Moshe Feinstein that disposable aluminum utensils do not require tefillas kelim. This was a position that I did not bring up here. It seemed to me to be a little bit further afield from our sort of overall introduction. But there is a discussion in Poskim as to whether disposable utensils require immersion at all or not. It might be that when we talk about immersing kelim, something that, you know, a clear utensil, that it might only apply to permanent kelim, meaning things that you keep and use and reuse, but things that are disposable might not meet that criteria. And there are some opinions who do that, and we all, I don't want to say we all, but it's generally popular to rely upon that opinion, meaning people will go to the store and buy an aluminum pan, and I don't know of many people who go to a mikveh and immerse their aluminum pans before they use them after buying them from the supermarket. So if you're able to prepare for Pesach using just disposable aluminum and eating on just plastic, it seems like he thinks that might be ideal to avoid any of the other loopholes that he's going to rely on going forward. If neither of these options work, and you can see there's also these different standards that he's putting out, different solutions he wants to raise. If these options aren't available, then the Shulchan Aruch permits transferring ownership of the vessels to a non-Jew in order to relieve the obligation of Tefillat Kelim and the sort of concurrent prohibition. However, this is not necessarily a reasonable option at this time when people are committed to maintaining standards of social distancing. It's not always easy to find a non-Jew to whom you could, you know, effectuate a proper sale with. Just to remind ourselves, we saw on the Halakhopedia site that there's a discussion of using online services to do so. That itself was a discussion about selling chametz. Right? Can one, you know, use online tools in some way to facilitate the sale of chametz? We'll see that in a little bit in Ravulik's discussion. So we've knocked out a couple options, right? If we could find a body of water, that would be great, but it's not always feasible. If we want to use disposable utensils, that would be great, but it's also not always feasible to prepare for Pesach using disposable utensils. Maybe we could try transferring ownership, but that could be complicated, especially if Rav Schachter would prefer that you not use online tools and meet with people in person to affect sales. So that's something that is also not necessarily a given. And so he brings us to our fourth option, which is declaring things ownerless. Since we are faced with a unique situation of great need and limited options, it is permitted to use utensils that have not been immersed after renouncing ownership of the utensils. Now, this is a tricky process, and so he offers, you know, very practical guidance on how to do so. When declaring the utensils as ownerless, one must do the following things. Number one, have full intent that they are truly declaring the items as truly ownerless. Are you doubling down on the word truly here? You have to really actually mean it. You can't just play pretend. And you have to believe that if someone were to take the item before the original owner were to reclaim them, they would be willing to let the item go. Right? It's a risk you have if you're, declare that your coffee pot to be ownerless. Yeah, that means that someone else could take it, and then they would be the new owner, and you'd have no right to take it back. Number two, the declaration must be made to three people who live in your neighborhood so that one of them has the ability to potentially acquire the item, and two people could be witnesses to say that the other person did not steal the item. Two of the people should be valid halakhic witnesses. This relates to the passage we had seen before about how to declare something ownerless. Rav Schachter believes that in order to declare something ownerless, one needs to do so in a way where someone would actually be able to take it from you. So I need to make it public enough that someone could take it, and that if I were to go to court and say that he stole the coffee maker from my house, there would be witnesses who would be able to testify. He did take it from your house, but he was allowed to do so. He was so entitled by the fact that you declared it ownerless. The third line, I think, is particularly interesting because this gets to a fundamental question about the entire process of being quarantined and isolated. This doesn't have to be done in front of three people. It can be declared over email or social media to three people, which is itself interesting, right? We've known that there are some processes that we allow one to use Zoom for, and some processes for which one is not allowed to use Zoom. So we don't usually have a minion, for example, over Zoom, but it seems like declaring things healthcare can be done over Zoom. What this reflects conceptually, I think, is that we don't need three people to declare something healthcare on any formal basis. Those of you who were here last week might remember we discussed witnesses by a wedding and how the witnesses aren't there just to prove that it happened, just as evidence for people to know about something. Rather, they actually effectuate, or they're part of the process by which the marriage is actually effectuated. This is not the case here. Here, all we need is that people actually know about it. So if I publicize it by email or if I publicize it by Zoom, that should suffice. I quoted on the original source sheet a position of Rav Moshe Feinstein in the context of a divorce where he says a similar thing, that a woman can appoint an agent to accept a get on her behalf, and she doesn't have to be in person to do so. She could use a telephone and call people. And as long as you know who's on the other end of the telephone and no one could have faked it, then that counts as a ability to appoint an agent. So there's some functions where you need actual presence of real people in a real place, and some functions where the knowledge is just enough. So this is one of those situations where just knowing about it matters. And then to close off his practical advice, after declaring the items are ownerless, you should move the items out of your physical house or apartment and let them remain outside for a few minutes, where someone could potentially come and take them. Right. In order to make this process a real process, so we don't feel like we're pretending, so we're not pretending. We actually mean that we're declaring them ownerless. We have to be willing to put them out and be willing to have other people claim them from us. And so if that means putting your coffee maker outside to let someone walk down the street and say, "Hey, a free coffee maker, I'd like that," then you should do that. Okay, so that's sort of rounds out Rav Shachar's presentation. He has a few other miscellaneous Pesach issues in this tshuva, but we're not going to look at those. And I also see that we're sort of running a little bit late on time.
Wait, Ted, did you put your coffee maker on the streets of Washington Heights?
So I spent Pesach with my parents in Kew Gardens Hills. So I put it out on the sidewalk and I texted a number of my friends in the neighborhood. If you'd like a coffee maker, there's one sitting on my sidewalk right now. A few minutes later, nobody had come. And I thought, hey, look, a coffee maker. I should start using this.
Perfect.
that was my solution. Following Rav Shachar in this regard.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. It's good you wear it in Washington Heights. Good.
Yeah, I think it would have been a different kind of experience for sure. But I also live on quiet streets, so I think that that also makes things a little bit easier. Okay. So I think for time purposes, we probably will not summarize see everything that Rav Woolig says. We won't read the whole thing inside. There's one or two things I think are worth pointing out. Number one is this section here. I made smaller font so people wouldn't notice it. But in the list, in the collection of literature of rabbis, not loving Pesach programs, here is another piece where, someone asked him about, making Pesach at home for the first time. And he gives the practical advice about the, being tovel your kelim. But he also says, by the way, I've spoken to a number of people who thought, wow, like doing Pesach at home was a really wonderful, spiritual experience. And if we stopped going to Pesach programs, we'd have so much more money to solve the tuition crisis and so on. So it's an enjoyable piece if you have a minute to look at it. Just had to, get that in there. So Rav Woolig actually doesn't like Rav Shachar's advice so much because despite all of Rav Shachar's sort of practical guidance to make it feel like a real declaration of ownership, of ownerlessness, a real declaration of hefker, nonetheless, you're, putting it outside, you're using it in your house for the whole holiday. There are certain positions that he points to that says, under such circumstances, dehave kishalo mamish. It is very much, it is actually yours. You declared it ownerless, that's fine, but you're using it. You had title to it before. Your only plan on this being a temporary thing, it's hard to say that you actually meant it to be ownerless. And so he defaults to Rav Shachar's first preferred option, which was to be able to sell it to a non-Jew. And he's not bothered by the practical concerns because he thinks that you could do it virtually. He suggests using the same way that one sold their chametz, many people, appointed the rabbi to do so via email. So he says also, Shenarach Hashanah al yedei harsha'ot be-email. You could appoint someone to sell those things on your behalf by email. And as for the actual process of effectuating the kinyan, effectuating the transfer, he says you could use PayPal. I particularly enjoy when rabbinic writings use terms like this. So he describes that as a practical option. Those of you who have ever watched a rabbi sell chametz might know that generally the rabbis will try to effectuate like 6 or 7 different possible modes of acquisition, different modes of kinyanim to like definitely cover all of your bases, only chametz on Pesach being a severe thing. So if one were to, you know, use those same standards for selling their kelim, I have no doubt that it would, you know, constitute a proper or effective sale. Okay, so that's, I think, a proper summary. I know we went a few minutes longer today than last week, and there's plenty more to look at. For example, this tshuva from Rav Rimon, which is a 14-page document, much more intensive than some of these shorter psakim that we saw. But just to sort of summarize what we've seen, we first introduced the mitzvah of tefillat kelim and the basic principles involved, the basic rules and regulations for this mitzvah. Then we looked at a number of exceptions or you know, for lack of, in order to avoid sounding cynical, I'll try to avoid the word loopholes, but certain circumstances that one could use to not be obligated in tefillat kelim. And then at some of the practical writings and contemporary writings about how to apply those rulings, including Rav Neventhal's practical guidance of, you know, we'll find a body of water, right? If you want to use a woman's mikveh, use that also. To the different solutions that Rav Willig, Rav Schechter, the authors at Halachapedia all try to advocate and present for us. And I'll stop sharing and stop the recording. Are there any